Welcome, everyone, to episode 342 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we're going to talk about some of the notable COVID tests that have come back since all the players entered the Orlando bubble. We're also going to hit on Rajon Rondo's broken thumb and what that means for the Lakers, the possibility of a few players unexpectedly returning to the Orlando bubble ahead of the NBA restart, and some notable Sixers lineup changes that Brett Brown has hinted at over the past few days. Before we get into all of that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews, and we are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today, as always, is a man who did not get paid $109 million to come off the bench, Morton Jensen. How's it going?
Oh, man, I wish. I wish I had. I would definitely take $100 million to come off the bench, or not even come off the bench at all. I'd be fine with it. Towel waving for 82 games? I would do it.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be very expensive towel waving, but someone's got to do it.
I mean, look, I would put my heart and soul into it for 82 games straight. If that was the deal, like, you get $109 million, and for 4 years, you just have to towel wave your ass off. I would be the most enthusiastic towel waver of all time.
Well, I mean, all of the players have been talking about, you know, the energy is going to be weird in Orlando because there aren't going to be fans in the stands, obviously. So they're going to need players on the bench to really, you know, the bench mob to give them that energy. So that role actually may be more important than it ever has been before. Maybe teams will start shelling out more money for guys who have the best bench mob celebrations or can get their teammates hyped up.
Nice. I'm available, NBA. Very available.
You just need to go down to Orlando and get your nose swabbed for 7 days straight, and you're in.
Oh, wait. Going to Orlando? I'm not available. No. No. I was kidding. I'm definitely not available.
You take that back. Yeah, you would never be welcome back at Denmark if you went down there.
No. That's true, right? I mean, if I went over there, I would basically be... Yeah, solituding, islanding myself. Like, yeah. I would never be able to come back,
right?
Until like 2030 or something, whenever you guys get a handle on it.
Correct. Yeah, at least until there's a vaccine out, for sure. We have a lot of news to get through today. So let's start with some of the notable COVID tests that have come out since all the players got to the bubble last Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Two players tested positive inside the bubble. Michael Beasley was one of them. We do not know the identity of the other player, as far as I know, but he has been quarantined. Right. So far, it seems like there has not been a widespread outbreak like we saw in MLS, which is great news. It seems like the NBA's protocol is working. We talked a lot about the Nets and Beasley last episode, so I don't think we need to spend too much time on him. I think the big news was Russell Westbrook came out on Monday and said that he had tested positive before the team even went. He and both he and James Harden did not join the team on their team flight to Orlando, which raised some eyebrows. And at the time, Mike D'Antoni said it was just a personal issue and they're going to be there in a couple days. Harden has since arrived in Orlando, which would at least seem to imply that he has tested negative twice or three times, whatever the protocol is, so he'll probably have to quarantine for a bit, but he should be back in action by the time the season tips off. Russ, his status is a little bit more up in the air. So, you know, more, we have largely avoided this asterisk talk because we wanted to see, okay, like, who's here in Orlando and who's going to be here and who's gonna, you know, like, come July 30th, who's actually suiting up. If Russell Westbrook, God forbid, cannot join the Rockets down in Orlando for the rest of the season, which we're not necessarily saying is the case, but let's just go, you know, worst case scenario right here, what would that mean for the Rockets?
Well, it certainly sets a lower cap on their ceiling, I would say. And you know, coming from me, that's saying something because I was not a Russell Westbrook believer, but I think this year, especially after they traded Clint Capella and went all in on the small ball lineup, Like, he's been really good in their final 14 games of the season, where they went 8-6, which, you know, granted isn't the best record, but it also takes time to you know, acclimate yourself to this whole new concept of a team. Mm-hmm. Westbrook's been averaging just under 32 points a game, but on more importantly, on 54.5% from the field. Like, he's just been going balls to the wall every single game. And like you and I have been talking about, even though this is months ago, like despite being a 6'3 point guard, he's being used as a sort of like a power forward. Mm-hmm. Like, he's just been asked to go downhill and into the box all the time, not in like a post-up setting, but just get into the teeth of the defense, get into the paint, whatever means necessary, and then we'll flank you with a ton of shooters. And that's been pretty effective for him. So not having that outlet and just basically losing 32 points per game, that's huge, right? I mean, I don't see who else on that roster can step up and take those minutes and not necessarily produce the same amount, but just do it in a way where you don't feel as though you're losing a major statistical production.
Yeah, I'm proud of you for saying, because I think we'll get into this with Rondo later, where it might help them more than hurt. I'm proud of you for not taking that low-hanging fruit with Westbrook.
No, not now. I will say, had this all happened like after 20 games of the regular season, I probably would have said that, because he was not good early on. He really wasn't.
Yeah.
But he, like, they just flipped the entire narrative right there, or he did.
Yeah, and I'm also, I know you said we talked about this months ago, but surely you mean at least three decades ago, right?
Yeah, oh, for sure. Okay. Also then, yeah. Yes.
No, but you're totally right. I think beyond the way they were using him, I mean, it's a stylistic change for Russ, too, just in terms of, you know, for years now, shot selection has been one of the biggest things he's been criticized about. Like, please, God, stop pulling up in transition for a three-pointer with 16 seconds left on the shot clock. That is a bad shot for 99% of the league. You are not Stephen Curry or Damian Lillard, the 1% who can get away with it. You were like a historically bad three-point shooter. Please dial back your volume, because the first 33 games of the season, he was taking almost five threes a game, shooting 23%. Like, you are doing your opponent a favor if you are taking those shots. Over the last 19 games, he was down to only 1.8 threes. Or sorry, 20 games of the season. 2.1 threes, shooting 34%, which, again, not great, but at least he cut his volume back in half. There were some games, especially in the middle of January, he went a four-game stretch in which he took one three-pointer. Like, that is the Russell Westbrook that we wanted to see, and that gives James Harden a break. I mean, that's been the whole narrative around Harden every year, is he has such a heavy load on his shoulders based on, I mean, usage rate alone. Like, he has one of the highest ones in league history. By the time the playoffs come around, he seems to wear down. And then, you know, you have things like where the team misses 27 straight three-pointers in a game seven. Having right. a guy like Russ, if Harden is having an off night, okay, you've still got another guy who can basically be not only, you know, a lead scorer who can score 30 or 40 points a game, but he can also be, you know, a triple-double threat, a guy who can orchestrate the offense on his own, run the offense through him, create shots for others. So without him, I mean, knock on wood, he will test negative very soon and we will join the team in Orlando and this will all be much ado about nothing. But if he is not able to rejoin the Rockets for whatever reason, yeah, I mean, you know, we were talking about them a couple episodes ago as like, could they be a dark horse title contender? Not without Russ.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, fingers crossed, Russ will be fine. And again, this will all blow over. But yeah, I mean, it's a real bummer. And this is, you know, luckily, I guess that's a perverse way to say it, but luckily, you know, the Rockets are not considered one of the chief title contenders. Because, you know, if this does happen with a guy like Giannis or LeBron or AD, Kawhi, Paul George, then I think you start to see the asterisk talk really pick up. But for now, knock on wood, we seem to be out of the woods in that regard. The other notable test that came back positive recently was Harrison Barnes of the Sacramento Kings. He said he's largely feeling fine, but he is still in Sacramento waiting clearance for the team, or for him to be able to join the team down in Orlando. Mort, the Kings are one of those teams in that mix for the number 8 seed in the West. Without Barnes, what does that do to the Kings' chances of catching up to the Grizzlies or jumping over the Pelicans and the Portland Trailblazers?
It doesn't really change anything, I think.
Oh, interesting.
No, I'm not saying that Harrison Barnes isn't a good player. I mean, he clearly has his value.
Mm-hmm.
I just am not a believer in the Sacramento Kings this season.
Oh, okay.
I don't think they're there. I don't think they're going to make that strong push. I think they have too many hurdles in front of them. I think they play too undisciplined. Plus, I think their coach is not great at his job.
Right. Yeah, okay. You mean it won't change anything because they weren't going to get the 8 seed, or they weren't going to force the play and jump over the Pelicans even with Harrison Barnes.
Right. Okay. That's what I'm saying. I'm not putting this at the feet of Barnes specifically. Although I will say, you know, I was kind of hoping for him to actually have a little bit of a bounce back year. I didn't feel as though last year he ended the season particularly well. Like, he was at like 16 points, 5 rebounds or something like that. And this year it's been like even worse, honestly. You know, under 15 points a game, under 5 rebounds. Like last year he leaned into the 3-point shot a lot, which I think was like a good way for him to actually establish himself a little bit more. And this year, it's less than 4 attempts per game. Like, he's been very timid, or at least very passive, which I don't really understand. Like, in Sacramento, you shouldn't really be needing shots there, because, like, who else is there? Like, you know, De'Aaron Fox, obviously, but he was injured for a pretty significant stretch. Rashawn Holmes, you know, was injured. Like, yeah, what's your competition? Buddy Hield?
Well, yeah, Buddy Hield and Bogdanović.
That's 2 guys. You should be able to, you know, get more than 11 shots per game in that setup.
Yeah, I mean, I think your point about Luke Walton is totally fair. Like, he's just been mishandling this roster all year. You can look no further than, you know, you've got a young, hyper-athletic point guard in De'Aaron Fox, and your team is 25th in pace.
Like, right.
That is criminal neglect. And, I mean, I think that is the one area where, If you're talking about schematic changes that, you know, maybe we could have seen in Orlando, like, hopefully the last 4 months, Luke Walton and his staff have spent this time self-scouting what went wrong, what went right, what did we do well, what did we not. And I think you pretty quickly come to the conclusion, like, we need to be running more. This is what got them so competitive last year, is they were one of the fastest paced teams. They were tapping into De'Aaron Fox's strength as, you know, being one of the fastest point guards in the NBA, being so athletic. You're negating that by running such a slow system. So Harrison Barnes could have been slotted in as the full-time 4. You know, you could have had Fox, Hield, Bogdanović, 1, 2, 3, and then Rashawn Holmes at the 5, or Marvin Bagley, take your pick. I don't really care. Probably Rashawn Holmes, if he can stop violating the bubble rules to pick up some postmates. So, you know, I think that could have at least given them something to build upon for next year. Even if they couldn't make the playoffs this year, you have 8 games to figure out, oh, okay, like, this is the system we should be running. Let's, you know, hit the ground running here, and then we could build upon that for next year. Whereas now, if Barnes can't join the team for whatever reason, you know, it's more of a hypothetical, okay, you know, we're probably going to play Bagley and Rashawn together, and I don't know that that's going to lend itself to running as much as a Barnes at the 4 full-time lineup would.
No, but I kind of like the idea of when it goes, you know, when it is slowed down, which at times it will be, because you can't run fast breaks like 80 times per game.
Mm-hmm.
I think Barnes is kind of like that counter option. Like, he seems to be a player who can function in a half-court setting because he can shoot, both from 3 but from mid-range. He's also one of those guys, like, given the time, he can back someone down in the post and do something. Like, he's one of those players, I think, who can adjust to both systems. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you slow down, like you said, if you slow down De'Aaron Fox, you take away one of his primary strengths. I think that goes in the same way as with Marvin Bagley. Honestly, Marvin Bagley playing in is what primarily is a half court offense. I don't think that suits his style. Mm. I'd also argue that the Bjelica, when he shoots the ball like that, is coming, you know, more efficiently in fast break situations. So yeah, I totally agree with that point. I think when you look at the overall season from the Kings, Barnes has just been in a weird spot. But again, you can say that about most Kings players, like Buddy Hield coming off the bench as well. Like this team, this is why I don't have any faith whatsoever in this year's iteration of them. It just seems it's been mishandled right from the jump.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Yeah. I think if you're saying that, you know, Barnes' potential absence will not affect the Kings' chances of making the playoffs, that's true, because the Kings aren't going to make the playoffs either way. That I have no objection to. One piece of good news on the COVID front: Nikola Jokic, who tested positive in Serbia and missed the team flight, couldn't join them, has arrived in Orlando, still looking skinny, so that's good. There are a couple notable Nuggets players who have not joined the team yet, Gary Harris and Michael Porter among them. They have not confirmed that they tested positive, but you can only connect the dots at this point. So fingers crossed, we'll see some full strength Nuggets. Or, you know, if you go back and listen to our Western Conference or our episode about dark horse contenders, just skip to the East, because we talked about Houston and Denver, and if they don't have, you know, Russ and Gary Harris and MPJ, all of our analysis is now null and void. So fingers crossed those guys can get down there soon. All right, wait. Let's turn to the Los Angeles Lakers. Rajon Rondo broke his thumb in practice over the weekend. It's going to require surgery, and the recovery period is expected to take 6 to 8 weeks. So that should put his return somewhere between the first and second rounds of the playoffs. So luckily for the Lakers, by the time they're playing games of consequence, Rondo should be back. But how will Rondo's absence affect them in the meantime?
Well, see, I'm way more nervous about something else. Do you think that the OR that Rondo is going to go into is up to his standard? is that going to be okay for him to go into the OR, and it's not some luxury hospital? Or maybe even if it is that kosher for him to go in there? I'm sitting here I'm really worried about Rajon Rondo's perception of what is, you know, enough quality for his sake. I really am.
Right. Like the cast the Motel that he'll 6 wear of hospitals.
Right. The cast that he'll wear, is that going to suit him? Mm. Should he get like some sort of an Amarni cast? I'm not sure.
Yeah. All very valid concerns.
Right. That's my way of saying I don't even care, because when you pull something like that, I don't care.
Yeah.
I have lost so much respect for Rajon Rondo after that thing. Like, that is just being so tone deaf.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. I don't care. And plus, he's not as good as he used to be, so it might even help the Lakers, honestly.
There we go. I was waiting for that. Yeah. I mean, I know a lot of Lakers fans probably agree with that sentiment based on, you know, the Lakers fans that I follow. Every time Rondo came on the floor this year, it was, no, put in Caruso. Right. So, yeah, I mean, it's not going to – look, by the time he comes back, like, whoever gets the eighth seed, more likely than not, will not put up much of a fight against the Lakers. So by the time he's back, it'll be the second round. That's when the games will start to matter more for the Lakers. So I don't think this materially affects their title chances in any way, because he should be back by the time those games really start to pick up. With that said, the absence of both Avery Bradley and Rondo now really does leave the Lakers in somewhat dire straits whenever LeBron is off the floor from a creation sense. I mean, you could say what you want about Rondo, but he was second on the team in assists at 5.0 per game in only 20.5 minutes. LeBron, of course, is leading the league with 10.6. AD is third on the team at 3.1. And then Alex Caruso is fourth on the team in assists at 1.8 per game in 17.8 minutes. So
right. Rajon Rondo could dribble. is what.
Right. Like, I don't know when LeBron is off the floor, who's bringing. I guess it's going to be Caruso, but otherwise it's like KCP, Kuzma, Danny Green, Dion Waiters, J.R. Smith. Like,
are we going to see Dion, the point guard version of Dion Waiters, being unlocked now?
They almost by default. And right. I mean, I think Caruso is probably going to handle that responsibility just because that's their best of a bunch of bad options. But like, I know it is popular to crap on Rajon Rondo because he is not the player he once was, but he did serve a pretty critical role for the Lakers. And, you know, I do think that this is something that could be a concern. And, you know, again, I don't think whoever gets the 8 seed is going to beat the Lakers in a 7-game series, but
right.
They are now more vulnerable in the minutes that LeBron is off the floor. And I wonder if that's going to lead to LeBron playing more minutes in that first round series than he otherwise would have had Rondo not gotten hurt.
Well, I mean, so here's the thing. I think we're looking at it a little bit wrongly, because for the Lakers specifically, this is just about having someone to dribble the ball off the court, dump it off to either LeBron or Davis, and then just kind of sit back, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't really need that typical point guard, that typical ball handler. Hell, even this year, we've seen plenty of examples of Anthony Davis grabbing a defensive board and just dribbling the ball off the court. We've seen that plenty of times. So I think for the Lakers specifically, this is just a matter of getting the ball into the front court and then handing it off to one of the, you know, two of the 6 or 7 best players in the NBA, and basically say, hey, make a decision, take a shot, do whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, I don't think you necessarily need that, you know, that secondary ball handler / playmaker. You just need someone who can dribble the ball like 8 times and then dump it off to one of those 2 guys.
Yeah. No, it's a fair point. I wonder if there are going to – I guess it – there will probably be fewer minutes wherein both LeBron and AD are off the floor now. Not that there should have been many of those to begin with, because then you're going to be relying on like Kyle Kuzma to create shots for himself, or you get Dion Waiters, J.R. Smith. We get to a dark place pretty quickly. So again, it's not going to mean anything major for their title chances, but I think it's just something to keep in the back of your mind, especially in conjunction with Bradley's absence, which is a much bigger deal in the grand scheme of things for the Lakers. But, you know, it's something certainly to watch in these seeding games. Like, the Lakers have such an advantage ahead of the Clippers and the rest of the West that, like, they're more or less locked into the 1 seed already. So it's not going to affect their seeding. They'll be fine in the first round regardless, but I do wonder if, you know, LeBron ends up getting a little more overtaxed than he would have otherwise, or even AD. I mean, maybe you just have to rely on both of those guys more because you don't have that secondary creator. And like, yeah, I mean, it sounds as easy as just dribble it up and pass to the front court, but like, we've seen that is a that skill is diminishing across the NBA. It is alarming how many players struggle with a very fundamental task of get the ball up and pass it into the front court. And, you know, when LeBron is off the floor and when AD is off the floor, other teams are going to smell blood. Like, they're going to know, oh, okay, cool. Like, these guys are dribbling it up. This is an easy opportunity for me to go in for a steal and create a transition opportunity on the other end.
I mean, if that's the case, then I wonder how far the Lakers are going to make it.
Yeah, it's fair. I mean, I think when they have a guy like Rondo to be that steady second unit presence, you know, that it does make a difference. Like, it's easy to diminish what he brings because he is so limited in a number of ways. But, like, the one thing you cannot say about Rajon Rondo is that he's not a steady presence who can run an offense still. Like, that is who he is. And then there's always, you know, the chance that playoff Rondo comes out again and he, like, throws 18 assists 1 game. You know, and I'm not predicting that that is going to happen. But even if he's just contributing what he did during the regular season, 7 points, 5 assists, 3 rebounds, just having that guy there does make a difference. It does at least give you the calming sense of, okay, LeBron's off the floor, AD's off the floor. our offense isn't going to totally skid to a halt. All right, so there's some other notable news about some players who we thought were definitely not going to return. They traveled with the team to Orlando, but all of their teams said they're not returning, or in one case, the player said he's not returning. So let's start with Victor Oladipo, Mort, who yep. spoke with Shams Charania of The Athletic recently, said, you know, after evaluation, he decided he wasn't going to come back. He's coming off the quad injury. He just wanted to focus on getting back to full strength ahead of the 2020-2021 season. Now news comes out Tuesday that, well, actually, maybe he will be coming back. It's still unclear either way, but it sounds like there's a possibility that he will. I'm sure, coincidentally, that ESPN's Brian Windhorst reported Tuesday that the remaining salary that he would miss or that he would lose out on if he did not play, that is in dispute. It's about $3 million. So if a healthy player decides not to play, they lose that money. If a player has an excused absence for whatever reason, they would not necessarily lose that money. So Oladipo, because he gave an interview saying he's healthy and able to play, he's participating in practices, the league seems to be trying to withhold his remaining salary, whereas the Pacers apparently are fine either way. They're like, we'll pay him, we don't care. But there is a dispute about this, which I'm wondering if that is part of the reason he's considering playing. But regardless of all that, what would Oladipo's return mean for the Pacers in that, you know, they're in that 4-5-6 bunch right now? Would that give them a legit chance to hold on to the 5 seed and even beat Miami in the first round if the Heat stay at 4?
That's a really good question, because over the past 2 years, he's played a grand total of 49 games. Do we have enough data to make that sort of conclusion at this point?
Not really. I mean, if you're looking at just this year in particular, you know, he came out and said when he first returned at the end of January that he just wasn't really his full self. I think, you know, right before the season shut down, he seemed to be rounding into form. That last game he played against Boston, he had 27 points on 9 of 16 shooting, 7 rebounds, 4 assists in about 29 minutes. So, yeah. You know, that was the all-star Victor Oladipo that we remember from a few years ago. But, yeah, it's a fair question. Like, what version of Oladipo are we going to get? I mean, it sounds like, based on, you know, how he's been performing in these practices, he looks good, apparently. But yeah, is he ready to walk into his normal, like, 30-plus minutes a game? Or are they going to have to be cautious, limit him to 20 to 25? I don't know the answer to that question.
Right. I think what you have to look at is the defense, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if he just gives you the defense and the passing, which he does have, like, that's an immediate asset, because he's a very, very good defender. And then if he can just be, like, a little bit opportunistic scoring-wise, like, I'm not saying he should forego scoring altogether, but I think he needs to pick his spots. It's going to be tricky, because, like, the team was, like, kind of forced to build around Sabonis a lot. Mm-hmm. And now you're kind of implementing a high-volume guy. That's going to carry on some difficulties, like, at least initially, I think. Mm-hmm. But overall, I mean, I can never sit here and say, well, getting Victor Oladipo back is a bad thing, because, right. Like, what's the alternative?
Right.
Like, they don't have right. Jeremy Lamb.
Yeah.
Like, what's the alternative here? Extending Justin Holiday's minutes? Extending Doug McDermott's minutes? Mm-hmm. Giving more minutes to Edmund Sumner? I mean, like, I don't know what the flip side is here.
Right. And that is ultimately the question. I think because Jeremy Lamb is out, like, you can point to, oh, you know, the Pacers did well without Oladipo to start the year, and they actually kind of hit a skid right when he returned. I think they went 1-6 in his first 7 games or something like that. And then they started to really round back into form. But yeah, they did that with a healthy Jeremy Lamb. Now that Jeremy Lamb is out, you know, you suddenly start to get to a point where, okay, well, our options are getting a bit limited. I mean, I guess you could slide Brogdon to the two and move TJ McConnell into the starting lineup, but then who does that leave you with as a backup point guard? Aaron Holiday, I guess. Or, yeah, I mean, I think probably the play is Justin Holiday moves into the starting lineup, gets minutes at the two, and it's going to be Brogdon, Justin Holiday, TJ Warren, Sabonis, and Miles Turner as your starting five.
Yeah. I mean, either way, I mean, I like Indiana. I think they're scrappy. I think they're undervalued. But I don't see a scenario wherein they are a legitimate championship contender either way.
Right.
Like, this is going to be one of the – like, even the first-round series, even if they make it to round two, it's going to be one of those things where you kind of just assume, okay, the Pacers are there, and now they won't be. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just there's no scenario I could see unfold realistically where the Pacers somehow make it to the Eastern Conference Finals.
Yeah, I agree with that. Do you think with a healthy Oladipo, are they more of a threat to beat Miami in round one at least?
Oh, yeah. Like, if we were talking about the Oladipo from 2 years ago, like the All-Star Oladipo, yeah, absolutely.
Even, like, I mean, let's just say we get the depleted version that we saw, you know, in those 13 games this year.
I mean, that's a significantly lower ceiling, I want to say. But, I mean, it can't hurt having the presence of Oladipo whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Like, this is why I always come back to when a guy is a good defender, that is just such a huge asset, especially when he's also a guy who can put up points. Because at least you would have something to offer. Like, imagine asking me this question if Oladipo was a horrendous defender.
Mm-hmm.
Then you would make the argument, oh, if he's not a good offensive player this year because he's injured and like the efficiency isn't there, well, then he's basically unplayable. But just the mere fact that he can stay on the court defensively means that the Pacers have some sense of luxury in that capability and does raise their floor a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, does it raise it enough to put them past Miami? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, maybe if Jimmy Butler gets written up more for dribbling a ball in his room at 3 in the morning.
Oh, man. That was some very, very good glancing in the media by Jimmy. I love that. God. That was...
My eyes did a full 360 in my skull, which I did not know was possible. But, yeah, when that story came out, I was just like, so quintessential. Jimmy Butler worked harder than everyone else. Hashtag heat culture.
And yet... you would still want him on your roster.
Oh, 100%, yeah.
Yeah. But if you actually raise a good point, because I had completely forgotten about the whole TJ Warren, Jimmy Butler beef.
Yeah.
Because now that you just mentioned Butler,
mm-hmm.
like, no, I'm going to change my answer to no. The Pacers won't be able to get past him because Jimmy is just going to take this so damn personally.
Yeah.
And then we can think all we want about his work ethic. I mean, but when push comes to shove and the ball tips off, like, he's in it. He would take this whole series very, very personally, and I'm thinking that he would just defend his ass off.
Yeah, and this is probably a topic that we could delve into for an entire other episode, but, you know, given how much time off all of these teams have had, I wonder if shooting takes a little while to get going. Especially, you know, some of these guys haven't shot probably in a couple months. So for it, that could work both for and against a team like the Heat, where, you know, guys like Duncan Robinson, Tyler Hero, Goran Dragic, even they might be a little colder, rustier than they were before. But the thing working in Miami's favor is that neither Jimmy Butler nor Bam Adebayo, that's the three ball isn't a big part of their game. So they might actually hit the ground running a little more quickly, and since defense is the scrappy defensive mentality is a big part of both of their games, like, that might enable them to get going more quickly than a team that is more predicated on shooting, even though, you know, a lot of their teammates, of course, that is what they bring to the table. So it'll be really fascinating to see how all of those different dynamics play out. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you either way. Regardless, unless Victor Oladipo is 27-18 Oladipo, you know, if the Pacers can hold on to that five seed and they walk into that first round series with Miami, or even if they slip to six and go against Boston, I would not be optimistic about their chances either way. With that said, David Gardner, a Bleacher Report, we're doing this like 30 of 30 or 30 days, 30 teams series this month. ahead of the restart, and he did was on the Pacers. He spoke with Nate McMillan, and McMillan was an assistant for Team USA back with Coach K, and I think it was 2008 and 2012. So he was talking about, like, hey, we need to basically approach this like this is the Olympics. Like, we don't have a ton of time to ramp up. We have a few weeks of training camp and quote unquote preseason with these scrimmages. We have the seeding games, which are kind of like the group stage of the Olympics, and then we're like right in the medal round. Like, we're going, the playoffs start really quickly, so we need to get into that mentality more quickly. And I wonder if the Olympic experience of him will kind of trickle down to his team. So just another thing to keep in the back of your mind when you're talking about the Pacers these next few weeks.
Right. I mean, I'm way too preoccupied, I think, on something, because you just brought up that shooters might actually be not necessarily as important given the return, because they might struggle. Does that mean that we are basically making DeMar DeRozan relevant again?
This might be the Spurs' only chance.
Wow.
Yeah.
Could you imagine the narrative if that happened? If he just like took over and became the instant star of Disney World?
Oh, my God. Oh, man. Jesse would do so many victory laps on you.
I'll take it. Yeah. I'll allow it.
Yeah, that's fair. Two other guys whose status is still up in the air, but more up in the air than we would have thought a couple weeks ago. One, Kelly Oubre Jr., who is with the team in Orlando. He's recovering from the torn meniscus that he suffered in early March. He says his health status is up to the staff, but he feels fine. Monty Williams, the Suns head coach, kind of poured some cold water on this and said, you know, there's a lot of benchmarks for a guy like that coming off of surgery. He's healed. His body looks great, but there's still some things he would have to be comfortable doing. So it's definitely not a sure thing that he will come back, but it sounds like right. There's a chance that he could. I mean, the Suns are six games behind the Grizzlies. They would have to jump over the Blazers, Pelicans, Kings, and Spurs to force that play-in game. If the medical staff does give the all clear for Oubre, do you think it's worth the risk bringing him back? Or if you were the Suns, would you just say, hey, let's get you healthy for next year?
Oh, for sure. He's way too important. Like, he is way too important for the long term.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely get him healthy.
Yeah.
I mean, at least with Oladipo in Indiana, they're in the playoffs.
Right.
That's something different entirely. With the Suns, I mean, look, if I was the Suns, I would look at it as, hey, you know what, Devin Booker, aren't you feeling like a little sharp pain in the knee? Aren't you? Like, hint, hint, aren't you feeling a little bit poorly right now? Just go back home and just make this something for the youngsters on the team.
Mm-hmm.
Oubre is too important.
Yeah.
I wouldn't risk it.
100% agree there. The other one is Jonathan Isaac, who's been out since January. He's saying, you know, this whole pause gives me the chance basically to return that I wouldn't otherwise have had. Again, like Oubre, the team has not said anything definitive. They just haven't necessarily ruled him out. Look, the Magic are going to make the playoffs because the Nets and the Wizards are, you know, the Walking Dead at this point. So honestly, the Magic are probably going to be the seventh seed, which means either a date with Toronto or Boston in the first round. Same question with Jonathan Isaac, as I asked with Kelly Oubre. Would you bring him back knowing that you are going to make the playoffs, but that you are, you know, probably looking at a first round exit? Or would you say, hey, let's get you healthy for next season?
So again, I look back at Oladipo because I would be receptive to the idea of bringing Oladipo back, but I think the Pacers have a higher ceiling, whereas, you know, the Magic, I just cannot imagine a scenario where they just don't get completely, you know, dismantled by Giannis and the Bucks.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really know, like, what does that provide them with? The playoff experience, I guess? Like, I don't know what the best outcome is here. Like, does the presence of Jonathan Isaac, does that nullify Giannis? No, it doesn't. But it might be interesting also to see whether he can be a potential Giannis stopper down the line. So maybe that's an argument to bring him on. I don't know, but I would just play this very, very carefully.
Yeah, me too, especially because he's up for an extension this offseason. So I guess, you know, from the Magic's perspective, you could look at it one of two ways. One, you would use the playoffs to get another data point and see, okay, you know, if they ran up against the Bucks and Giannis, or if they ran up against the Raptors and a guy like Pascal Siakam, can Jonathan Isaac be that primary defender? I mean, before he got hurt, he was playing incredible defense, like all mm-hmm. defense caliber. I mean, really, really impactful multiple position defender. You're going to need that to beat a team like the Bucks or the Raptors. They are totally dead in the water without him, but I don't know that they have much of a better chance with him. So, like, I don't know. I probably, if I'm the Magic, I would not bring him back. But then again, I look ahead to next year wondering how that, if we're even going to have a season. So maybe it's just like, there's no like day like today because we don't know if there's going to be a tomorrow.
You know what? That's actually true. And that might also be an argument for Oubre on the Suns. Like, we just don't know when we're going to get the 2021 season. So maybe this is like the best example of just, or the best chance rather, to just get them out on the floor.
Right, right.
Man, there are so many layers to this that it is far more complicated than people make it out to be.
Yeah, yeah. Well, more. Let's wrap up with this because after talking about injuries and COVID tests and all that good stuff, we have actual basketball news to discuss and analysis, which is it. Honestly, this is the first time I've been excited to talk about real basketball in 4 months now. And I feel like it's really been our first chance to talk about real basketball in 4 months. On Monday, Brett Brown of the Sixers revealed that he has been playing Ben Simmons at the four in practice, which meant Shake Milton has moved into the starting lineup as the full-time point guard, which also means Al Horford is now the richest reserve in the NBA, coming off the bench for $109 million, which is great asset allocation. Good job, Sixers. Mort, what do you think about the move, Ben Simmons being off the ball at times now?
I actually love it. I love the fact that because you can do several things with him. You know, I've brought this up before as well, and Tom West from Liberty City Ballers, or no, Liberty Ballers, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Liberty Ballers. Yep. I always want to call it Liberty City Ballers for some reason. he made the point as well on Twitter that having a player who is capable of both running pick and roll as the ball handler and screener, and also functioning as someone who can, you know, free roam offensively away from the ball and kind of cut to the basket for alley-oops and layups and whatnot, that just brings your team a ton of offensive flexibility. And he's not wrong. Having Ben at the four is such a interesting shakeup. Because it doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to be playing the four, you know, defensively, mm-hmm. but it's just as offensively he would be, you know, a playmaking force. He would be Draymond Green on steroids.
Yeah.
But more importantly, like he would lean into that whole, you know, Pascal Siakam, Giannis Antetokounmpo type, like a big forward who can handle the basketball and get into the teeth of the defense by himself. Mm-hmm. I love how this has freed him up a little bit more, or how it's, you know, theoretically would free him up. I think his idea of constantly being this point guard, I think that just carried a little bit too many responsibilities, I want to say. And I think removing him from that and just trying to test him out at different positions is good for him. Because I don't look at Ben Simmons and go, hey, he's a point guard. Oh, he's a shooting guard. Oh, he's a small forward. Whatever. I don't look at him as a positional player. I look at him as a basketball player who we should be talking about as one of those guys who play a brand of basketball that is positionless. Like, if you ask me, what position does Luka play? Like, I don't know. Like, what is he? Is he a point guard? Is he a small forward? Is he somewhere in between? Like, there's so many different variations now. Mm-hmm. And I think for Ben to kind of lean into that is a major asset for Philly.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what, you know, so Brown and Joel Embiid spoke with reporters Monday, and that's when we found out about these changes the first time. And then Ben spoke with reporters on Tuesday. And I think it was Keith Pompey of the Philadelphia Inquirer who was asking him, like, you know, kind of just, hey, like, how did this come about? Are you okay with this? You know, like, how does it feel playing the four? And Ben was like, look, man, I don't conform to positions. Like, that's for on you guys. Like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever. I'm just a basketball player. So I think, you know, some of this is obviously going to be an actual schematic change, like having him operate off the ball. We started to see it more this year than we have in years past. But he was still, you know, the functional point guard most of the time he was on the floor. Like, having Shake Milton be that primary ball handler is going to be a change. I don't think this means Ben is never going to operate as the ball handler. Like, I think when Shake is off the floor, Ben probably is going to be that guy, because the other options are Howell Neto or Alec Burks, neither of whom you're going to trust more than Ben Simmons in that scenario. So,
or even when Shake is on the floor, though.
Yeah. Yeah, like, it's going to add a degree of unpredictability to the Sixers' offense, which I think they desperately needed. I mean, Shake is a much better shooter than Al Horford, so that's going to help, in theory, that should help some of the spacing concerns that come with, you know, having Simmons and Embiid together. I think, ultimately, like, the problem with the Sixers' offense this year wasn't Simmons and Embiid, or Simmons and Horford, or Embiid and Horford. It was all three of them together. When all three of them played together, the offense ground to a halt. When it was just two of them surrounded by shooters, it often worked. Their defense wasn't necessarily as strong, but their offense wasn't a gigantic eyesore. So this is Brown's way of saying, hey, let's try to figure things out. Like, we're not just going to keep forcing this clunky fit offensively. We're going to actually see if we can tap into some of Ben Simmons' strengths, because, you know, he was saying, like, look, if Ben has to get the ball every time off a make, off a miss, whatever, and he's dribbling it up the floor against a set defense, we're taking away one of his greatest advantages, which is speed. Like, yep. if someone can rebound outlet to him and he's running up the floor already, he's really fast. He's really athletic. He could either take it up himself, or if someone's running up the floor with him, more likely than not, that's going to end in an easy bucket. So it's going to be a change for sure, and I think it's going to be a positive one. The question, I guess, is what does this mean for Al Horford both this season and moving forward?
It's meant what it was always meaning, going to mean for Al Horford, and there's an expiration date on his Philly tenure.
Yeah,
that's been the case since the very moment he signed the contract, and I think everyone knew it. I would be shocked if deep down inside Horford himself was like, "Oh, I'm going to be a Sixer for life." No,
yeah,
it doesn't add up. It never did. And, you know, the thing that complicates matters, in my opinion. And I'm not saying that he complicates matters. It's Tobias Harris. Because Harris has become, you know, in today's NBA, more of a four than a three.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just made it even more difficult, because now you had to, like, find a way to play a 7-2 center, a 6-10 Ben Simmons, Al Horford, and a Tobias Harris who has developed naturally into more of a four than a three.
Right.
Like, all that just became so jumbled up, and now you just had to make a call. And part of that was, hey, put Al Horford on the bench.
Right.
And it was just a necessity. And it's really a tough blow for Horford, because let's agree on something. Even though he didn't work well in the starting lineup with his team, like, Al Horford undoubtedly is still a starting caliber player. I mean, good Lord. It's ridiculous to insinuate otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
He just shouldn't be a Sixer. He should be on a different team, getting the starting five spot or whatever. And the Sixers, instead of Horford, should have, oh, I don't know, a point guard, maybe?
Right. Right. I mean, that's the good thing from the Sixers' perspective. Two good things, really. One, like, this is going to give them the chance to try this out, much like we were talking about before with who was it that we were talking about? The
Jonathan Isaac?
No, I think it was, I don't remember. Go back and listen 30 minutes ago. This is how my brain's working these days. But it's going to give them a chance to try this thing out for 8 games and see, like, oh, okay, this is what we need to do moving forward. This is how we can prioritize our draft plans or our free agency plans. I mean, they've again, they've like toyed with this in the past. It just, they didn't actually really go full force with it. So like maybe I don't know that Shake Milton is necessarily the long term answer at point guard. I mean, he's played really well, in those, especially like as a starter this year, in those minutes when Ben was out with the back injury. He had that game against the Clippers where he scored 39, and like, you know, I don't expect him to continue shooting 50% from deep. I think that is a lofty expectation.
Right, but he does lean into more being of a two than a three or a one.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm optimistic about these changes. I think they are good, long overdue. We saw, I mean, before the season shut down, which again felt like 5 years ago, we saw Brett kind of moving in this direction. There was the game against the Clippers right before the All-Star break where he did bench Horford. And, you know, he kind of staggered Embiid and Horford's minutes almost exclusively without each other until the fourth quarter, which is when they started playing more together. And, you know, it was like kind of like closing time. We need our defense more than our offense. And let's like just please God be functional for 12 minutes. And somehow they were. So I think, you know, if you're looking ahead to the playoffs, that will potentially be a strategy. But then Brett also came out and said, look, I want to play Joel 38 minutes a game in the playoffs this year. So if he actually sticks to that, there's inevitably going to be overlap between him and Horford. Like Al Horford is not going to only play 10 minutes a night.
Right.
So, you know, if there are Sixers fans out there thinking like this means Embiid and Horford are never going to play together, I would back down on that hope, because I don't think that is the case. I do think it's going to decrease their overlap, which is good. But yeah, I think they are still going to overlap to some extent. And, you know,
yeah, they're going to have to.
Yeah, which is fine. I mean, it's, I wonder how they will do, you know, when they do overlap, other than, you know, closing minutes of the fourth quarter when you're probably going to have Simmons out there with both of them. Like, maybe the answer is just not having Simmons on the floor with those two. And, yeah, like, maybe if you have Shake and Tobias and Furkan Korkmaz out there, all of a sudden you've got three shooters around them, they're actually going to have the floor spacing they might need to succeed. It's like when you put guys like, you know, if you put those two with Simmons and Matisse Thybulle, all of a sudden there's going to be five guys within 10 feet of the basket on defense because everyone is going to be daring everyone to shoot.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, I mean, honestly, this boils down to one thing and one point, and it's one we've been regurgitating for you for months now. The Sixers need more reliable shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And it would help them that if every acquisition didn't forget how to shoot.
It would. It would indeed. I mean, maybe, you know, we didn't really get much of an opportunity to see Alec Burks and Glenn Robinson III, both of whom they brought in ahead of the trade deadline. I think both guys played like 10, 11, 12 games with the Sixers and both immediately forgot how to shoot. So they are officially Sixers now. I mean, it'll be interesting to see kind of how the playoff rotation shakes out, just because there's not going to be enough minutes for, you know, if Shake moves into the starting lineup, you're probably going to have one of Alec Burks or Raul Neto off the bench. I'm guessing Burks just because of what he brings as a shot creator. Then you've got Horford, of course, who's going to be playing substantial minutes. So that's already seven guys. Then you still have Furkan, Matisse, Glenn Robinson III, and Mike Scott. So that we're already at 11 names, and I promise you Brett Brown is not running an 11-man rotation. So seeing which of those guys are the odd man out, it might change on a matchup-by-matchup basis. Maybe if you're going against Boston and you need more wing defense, a guy like Matisse will play more, whereas if you're going against like Toronto and you're not necessarily need as many wing defenders because you're going against Kyle Lowry and Fred VanVleet, you can get away with playing someone like Korkmaz instead, who's going to give you the shooting but not as much defense. Figuring out what Brett Brown is going to do in these eight seeded games and then in the playoffs is like one of the biggest questions heading into Orlando, really, for any team. Like, the Sixers' ceiling and floor, there may be no bigger gap in Orlando between any team in terms of like the variance between, if everything goes right for the Sixers, they still might be that team we thought they could be coming into the year. They still might be that high-level championship contender. They could also very easily get knocked out in the first round. And we don't know which version is going to show up, but I'm really interested to find out.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Now, I mean, I know that you, at least in our DM conversation, is very big on the whole Philly's going to win the championship thing.
Mostly to troll. Yeah, I just think it'd be super funny if, given how terrible the season has been, like an aggravating team like the Sixers would be the perfect, most befitting champion for this type of season.
I mean, I'm almost rooting for it, if only for Alex to record a video drunk off your ass celebrating the championship.
I don't even know if my emotions are so far removed from basketball right now. Like, I can't imagine getting mad about the Sixers right now. And I know I probably will in a couple weeks, but like, it's honestly hard to fathom right now. It's like, there's so much other stuff going on in the world that I can't, like, I can't think of how I could possibly get mad about something as stupid and trivial as basketball.
That is very, very fair.
But that, I think that also just means this house has aged me 15 years in 3 weeks.
Okay. That is also very true, considering what you're telling me, like, what you've been looking for in terms of shopping, what was it, lawnmowers, and, like, all the boring grown-up stuff.
Yeah, we got the lawnmower, so we're good there. But yeah, it's
nice.
But yes, I feel like that was a very dad thing to say. Like, what could I get mad about basketball? How immature. It's like, no.
Especially without having a kid, even. Like, just imagine how dad you're going to be when you have a kid one day.
Oh, God.
You're going to be 80 in a couple years.
I know. All of my hair is going, it's already going gray, but I'm just going to immediately wake up and look like Santa Claus one day.
Yeah, because the beard cut is going to come automatically.
Right. It'll just be totally white. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
at which point, Alex is going to reconsider this whole marriage.
Right. Yeah, I got to wait a couple of years until she actually makes real money. yeah, all of that is to say, I we've been recording for a while, and both of us have just been like, the season is happening, I guess. It was genuinely nice for this Sixers story to come out this week, and it was like the first time I thought analytically about basketball in a while, and like actually cared. Like, it was a very strange sensation. So, like, I'm getting increasingly optimistic and excited about this season. I think, you know, getting all the players to Orlando, making sure that there was no widespread outbreak like we saw in MLS, that was the first big hurdle, and then we're not totally out of the woods yet, but, you know, fingers crossed that we'll avoid any horrible breaking news in the next couple days. And if the tests of the next couple days all come back negative, you gotta start feeling pretty good about this, the NBA actually being able to pull this thing off.
Yeah, I mean, so look, full disclosure, much like you, I've been pretty down on the whole idea. Now, granted, I haven't been as frustrated as you, in part because I don't live in the United States. I live in a country that can actually figure out how to handle the coronavirus, so this isn't day-to-day issues for me. I can actually go grocery shopping without wearing a mask, because we have a handle on things. So your perspective is definitely very different, because you live in a place that doesn't.
Correct.
And that's just putting it kindly, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of like the NBA, I've basically just decided to be a little bit more positive about it and just basically look at it as, you know what, this thing is happening, so might as well just make the most of it. Of course, safety has to be the primary concern. As long as that is handled the way that it should be, I'm good to go. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, look, the NBA was kind of saying this, and Greg Popovich, I know, is the one who said it too, like, this bubble might be the safest place in America right now. Like, given
which is so depressing,
yeah,
in a way.
But like, given all of the precautions they're taking and the amount of money they're throwing at this thing, like, you know, watch Matisse Thybulle's vlogs that he's been doing. It is, they're taking it as seriously as they should be, which is great.
Right.
And, you know, like, again, we joked about Rashawn Holmes earlier. Rashawn Holmes is locked in his room for the next 7 days because he violated the protocol. And that's, it sounds strict, but that's what you need. Like, you need to have, I mean, it's good almost that they had a cautionary tale like that so early in this process to send the message like, hey, we are not screwing around. Like, this was not, you know, we say that this, what we're going to do, but we're actually just going to slap you on the wrist. It's like, no, you violate this thing. You are in your room for 10 days. Deal with it. And I guarantee you, based on Rajon Rondo's reaction to his room, none of those guys want to be stuck in their room for 10 days. So I think this actually, like, that really might serve as a deterrent in terms of, you know, guys violating this protocol. But again, like, these next few days are going to be really critical. So I would just encourage everyone, regardless of whether you've been skeptical of the return like we have or, you know, excited the whole time, like, no one should be rooting against this thing right now. Like, we've we've reached the point of, you know, like, I don't want to say no return because there's a very easy chance that if there was a widespread outbreak, they would shut everything down again. But we've reached the point they are doing it. Like it or not, they're doing it. Everyone is there. So now you should not be cheering for someone to test positive inside the bubble, outside of quarantine, just to, you know, take your victory lap and say you were right and it was a bad idea the whole time. Like, plenty of people.
I hope nobody cheered for that because we don't know the long-term ramifications.
Right.
Like, that would be evil.
Right, right. I mean, like, you know, no one should be rooting for anyone to contract coronavirus except for a few very special leaders in our country, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. I have no qualms saying it out loud.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, we will wrap up. But thank you to everyone for joining. As always, hope you're staying safe out there. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You don't want a movie review?
Oh, no, not after last time.
Oh, come on. I'm gonna do one anyway. So I don't know if you've seen it, but The Old Guard on Netflix, brand new, Charlize Theron.
Have not seen it.
Okay. Well, this is like, this would have been one of those, you know, summer blockbuster popcorn flicks in the movie theater. It is very, very entertaining. I would definitely advise everyone to go watch it. It is great entertainment. It's possibly the start of a very successful franchise.
Oh.
And it's right there on Netflix.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, definitely. Once I finish Love is Blind, I will check it out.
Oh, God. Don't ever question my taste in movies or TV when you watch what you do.
Mort, I need to know if Jessica and Mark are going to make it. Spoiler alert, they will not.
Again, never question my taste. My God. Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, on that note,
yeah.
Don't die, I guess.
Thank you. You too.